SNI Digital, Innovations in Learning, the new 3D Live Video Journal, in association with SNI Surgical Neurology International, a 2D internet journal, is pleased to present another in the series of SNI Digital interviews with clinical neuroscience leaders. Today's interview is with Mitch Berger, who is well known worldwide, and he's going to talk about medicine, neurosurgery, brain tumors, and life. Mitch has a very long CV. He's been an associate professor and professor at the University of Washington, was the chair, head of neurosurgery at UCSF, one of the big, large and successful programs in the country and in the world. Is a director of the UCSF Brain Tumor Center. He's been interested in that really for his whole career. Been the president of numerous specialty societies, has won many awards of recognition and in many endeavors in which he's been asked to participate.
There we go.
Okay. And I'll edit this. So anyway, I'd like to welcome Mitch Berger. Mitch has had an illustrious career. I've known him for a long time. And Mitch, maybe to start out, maybe you can tell us, I think you started out with Charlie at UCSF. Is that right?
Yeah. I was a resident there with Charlie Wilson and went there in particular because of my interest in neuro-oncology and developing new surgical techniques for taking out tumors safely.
That was at a time when there wasn't a lot going on in brain tumors and treatment. I think Charlie had probably the most advanced area there where he was really putting a team together. How'd you get interested in that? Is that because nobody else was doing it, or was it a challenge, or what?
Yeah, I think there are a couple of reasons. One is I was impressed by how dismal the prognosis was with most of these primary tumors. I was impressed with Charlie's concept, which was to operate on patients, but to combine it with a team science approach to try and come up with translational opportunities to improve what was the dismal prognosis at that point in time. So I liked the concept of how he was doing this and building a team of investigators who were looking at every piece of tissue that ever came out of a patient, trying to study it, investigate it, and look for new potential therapies, you know, to try to improve this disease.
No, I think that's really good. I was on a grant committee to look at Charlie when he was in Kentucky. He had a brain tumor grant. He didn't approve it. He went to New Orleans, and I think typical of his personality, he was determined. He had goals. He kept working at them. At the time, may not have been people didn't understand it, wasn't popular, but I think if you looked 50 years later, it turned out to be right. Multidisciplinary approaches to these problems.
Yeah, I think the only thing that dramatically changed was the overwhelming concept back then with Charlie and his peers to be not as aggressive with the surgical approach as it turned out to be later. In other words, we were at a very difficult point in neuro-oncology from a surgical point of view in the late 70s, early 80s, where biopsy only was the rule of thumb. And in fact, all of the neuro-oncologists around the world advocated for that, told us we were wrong by doing anything more than that. And that's where the field was. And then I think we decided, or at least I decided, to do something very, very different, which was to really work on technologies that would make it safer to do a radical resection. So the goal here was to build a career around radical resection, maximizing extent of resection, doing it safely, with the understanding that there was a risk in doing that, that we might not advance the field, we might make patients worse. But I had a hunch that we weren't really moving the needle very much back in the late 70s and early 80s, and we needed to do something radically different. So that was the diversion early on.
I think just for the perspective of the audience, the microscope was just being introduced. People became interested in that. Glioblastoma was still not a really attractive area because the survival wasn't good and we didn't have any good therapy. And I remember I was at Roswell Park and we were, and Guy Owens was there injecting methotrexate in the carotid artery and and you remember that was a very early primitive approach, but people were trying at that time. And so for you to think about this, to do this further, just to put it into perspective, that's a revolutionary, you are alone when you're thinking about that, is my guess.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it was really bucking the system. I was, you know, heavily criticized in the beginning about trying to take that approach because the feeling was after, you'll recall, studies by Dandy, where Dandy did hemispherectomies, and this didn't move the field forward, primarily because we didn't have the adjuvant therapies at that point in time, and we certainly didn't have the imaging, so we didn't really know what the hemispherectomy was doing. But based on that, the feeling was, well, he's already tried it, he's done it, doesn't work, don't do that.
I remember reading a paper by Busey. Paul Busey at the time was operated on a guy with glioblastoma. You remember this paper? It was absolutely, I never forgot it. He did a hemispherectomy on the patient, hoping that he could cure the tumor. And remember he said in the paper, the patient came back to curse me because it occurred. I think that was almost the title of the paper. So that was the milieu at the time. It was really a kind of hopeless. That's what people were thinking. So let me show you another. I'm going to show you a paper that here. Can you see it on the screen? This thing.
Yeah.
This is a paper. At that time, I did a review on neuro-oncology for Baker and his textbook at that time, and I came across this paper. I've never forgotten about it by Shearer. You remember this paper?
Yeah, the secondary structuring of Shearer.
Yeah, and he did. It was a fabulous paper. I mean, he went and he took a whole series of people with brain tumors, and he did multiple sections, and then looked at the pathology. Came up. Can you see this?
Yes.
Came up, and he said only about 30% of all gliomas. I'm doing this so the audience can understand the environment. 30% of all gliomas were circumscribed. Okay, which is positive. That's not a negative. But people didn't take it that way. And then 60% have a more diffuse character with a widespread zone of growth exceeding the macroscopically visible tumor. 20% of those must be considered diffuse processes with no circumscribed tumor, which brings us up through your career. I want to take a detour. I'm going to just stop this for a minute and ask you, why did you go to work with George Ojeman in Seattle?
Well, because I had decided early in my career that I was going to be a very aggressive surgeon as it related to gliomas, that I was going to test the hypothesis that extent of resection affected outcome. I also realized, having seen so much morbidity from these surgical procedures, that we had to rethink the way in which we were doing it. And I had no clue how to do it, but I started to understand some of the early epilepsy type of investigative literature which looked at language localization. And George was doing a fair amount of this, as was André Olivier at the MNI. And I started to see that because George was doing these cases awake, I thought there was a potential way in which to do these procedures, testing language, looking for motor systems, etc., and trying to avoid the morbidity. I came to the conclusion that it couldn't hurt, it can only help, and I needed to see whether or not these techniques were applicable.
Well, also, I'm sure you looked back and said, I think I can do better than what we're doing now, which was basically either biopsy or giving up. I know in Europe, I remember reading a paper in Egypt where if it looked like a glioblastoma on the imaging, they wouldn't do anything or biopsy it, which was really not a very good treatment at that time anyway. So you got to be able to do better than that. I'm sure you were thinking that way.
Yes. Yeah, I was thinking that way.
To develop this innovative attitude and this attitude of being aggressive, it must have come from, did it come from Charlie or come from your family?
Well, no, I think it came from Charlie, but Charlie just didn't have, if I can, just be truthful about it, I don't think he had the patience to deal with it. It was clearly something that if you were going to do an aggressive surgery, it wasn't going to happen within 30 minutes of entering the tumor. It had to be done in such a way that you had to look at the function, investigate the function, determine where it was, work inside it, work around it, and do everything you could to get those patients out in good shape. And I just don't think he had the patience to do it, but he had the foresight to say, look, I think we should be doing more aggressive surgery. But his way of doing it was to go in the middle of it, aspirate, stay inside the lesion, and then to take whatever came from it and to accept the morbidity. And I just wasn't willing to do that.
Yeah, but again, for the audience, that was the common approach to it at that time. So okay, so let's fast forward, and let's go to I think I looked at your 2020 paper, which I thought, Mitch, I thought that was just a superb piece of work. You can see that on the screen here.
Yeah, right.
You have a cast of 100 here, but I think that fits with your thinking, and you involved the Mayo Clinic and other, and I think it was another institution, I can't remember, but in putting this together, it was just an outstanding study, extremely well done, and then we come to the conclusion here, which is, and I'm fast forwarding today. In the conclusion, you state that look, I'm going to. This is enhancing in the non-enhancing portion of the tumor, resection of the non-enhancing and enhancing portions in the tumor in conjunction with molecular and clinical information with validation of external tests, so forth and so on. Study supports maximal extent of resection of the enhancing tumor in younger patients, in addition to maximal resection of the non-enhancing portion, regardless of the molecular status. So, and this is you talk about how you do that. So we're talking about, this is 50 years later. I know you're only 55, but this is, I mean, that's a lot of time here. And here it's a reality. Tell us, so you would take George's techniques, which he does for mapping speech and so forth. You come back, you apply it to people who've got tumors, and sure, it's a frontal lobe or the occipital lobe, but obviously you can get into very sensitive areas, and you use that to locate where they are, and you use brain mapping and your stimulation techniques, and you go and resect the tumor, and this initially is a tumor that is, as you stimulate, the ones that are away from sensitive brain. Am I correct about that?
Yes, And I think there were a couple of other steps along the way that influenced this thought process. And that was one, a very insightful paper that was written years ago in the radiation oncology literature showing that when these tumors, the glioblastomas, fail, they fail 95% of the time within 2 centimeters of the contrast enhancing margin. So that was a clear understanding of where the bulk of the disease was. The second was the studies that Pat Kelly did. And Pat Kelly had an idea of focally resecting the enhancing tissue, but at the same time, he was doing these serial deep section biopsies looking at infiltrating tumor cells. And what he also showed was that the vast majority of these infiltrating tumor cells were within a few centimeters of the contrast enhancing margin. So, based on that, the philosophy in my career was do the resection of the contrast enhancing tissue and do it safely. Get that morbidity well under 2 or 3%. Then, if you can do that, go to the next step. The next step was go beyond the enhancement into that zone of risk, which is the flare abnormality on MRI scans. That's the brain adjacent to the contrast enhancing tumor, which we call the non-contrast enhancing tumor. And what happened with that was the statement in that paper that if we take out the enhancing tumor and we leave less than 5 cubic centimeters of non-contrast enhancing flare, those patients, by achieving what we dubbed as a gross total resection plus, otherwise known as a super total resection, that those patients got into a 36-month median survival for the classic IDH wild type GBM, regardless of MGMT status. So that, I think, was the defining moment, in several years ago, 3 years ago, 3, 4 years ago, to put that into print, that regardless of the molecular status, we're now at an age where the standard of care for glioblastoma surgically is to achieve a complete enhancing resection, as well as to go as far out into the flare as is safely possible. That is the best option for the patient.
Well, let's go into that a little bit because this gets into what you're working on now. And I'll go back to the paper by Shearer. And this is yours here. And so the question is the non-enhancing area. They're talking about 60% of all gliomas have a diffuse character, widespread a zone of growth exceeding the macroscopically visible tumor. And that gets into how do you identify, let me get out of this for a minute. How do you identify the tumor? It's the tumor margin. It has the growth margin with all the blood vessels and so forth. And then you get the infiltrative margin, which he says not only goes for a small distance, but it can go for a long distance. So a lot of the work has been spent on using imaging agents, I guess, to see if we can find where the non-enhancing tumor is, right?
Well, yes and no. That is correct. We use agents in imaging that extravasate from disrupted blood-brain barriers like gadolinium to find out, where the bulk of that angiogenic tumor is located. The issue is how do you find these infiltrating tumor cells? And that's been a tough one because the ALA, or the aminolevulinic acid, which gets into a tumor cell, has nothing to do with the blood-brain barrier. You could see those en masse, but it's got to be more than, several millimeters in thickness. So that is not a good way to identify microscopic tumors. So the way that we've been advocating and publishing, we just published this work in Nature Medicine, was to use a technique discovered by an Indian physicist by the name of Raman. Many years ago, Raman 80-plus years ago, identified a strategy in which you could shine light through tissue, and based upon the reflectance and the characteristics and the time frame of that reflectance pattern, that you could identify tumors that were amorphous, meaning cells that were amorphous, meaning they weren't normal glial cells or normal cells in general. And so this is a technique called Raman-stimulated histology, where we are able to take tissue in the operating room, and within 1 to 2 minutes, we get a curve based upon the reflectance of light. And using an artificial intelligence algorithm, we're able to determine, based on normal tissue from cases like epilepsy, et cetera, we're able to distinguish tumor cells infiltrating from non-tumor cells. So the next step from that paper I wrote in 2020 is to not only get into the flare, but now do a Raman histology study that looks at different degrees of removing these infiltrating tumor cells to see if we can even improve survival further.
Let me take you back a few years to the time when you started doing the work. Remember the work at the NIH when they were doing leukemia? Well, this is, you're talking about a solid tumor in the brain. Leukemia is a diffuse blood tumor. And using some of those statistics, if you calculate it out, about a 100-gram tumor is about 10 to the 11th cells. I think this is from my NIH days. And so if we look at surgery would take 2 logs of cells out. Radiation may take another 1 to 2 logs of cells out. So we're down to 10 to the ninth, 10 to the seventh. Maybe chemotherapy will take another. We're down to 10 to the sixth. We still got a million or 100,000 cells that we can't see, which fits with what Shira was saying.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
And so the reason it comes back is because you can't get it all.
That's correct. You can't get it all. But you have to understand that not all of these cells are programmed to enter the cell cycle, to proliferate, to create angiogenesis. Some of these cells don't do anything. They're part of the microenvironment that do not stimulate growth. Obviously, they exist. There's a potential for them to change because they are neoplastic. They're programmed to be that way. But the reality is that a lot of times when you take out the mass of the lesion, you reduce the cytokines that are produced by that tumor that stimulate those idling cells to do something. So it makes sense. And I think that's what's proven the theory that if you take out the bulk of this tumor, you can reduce the growth kinetics of these infiltrating cells and potentially keep them in an idling state longer.
Have you written that up? Because I don't know that.
No, that's something that would be almost impossible to prove, but it is probably a leading theory now in terms of cytokine-induced growth from the tumor microenvironment to these cells that are proliferating or entering the cell cycle. So
Well, so now we get to, and this, we're in 141 countries, so there's people all over the world looking at this. And there's some people in low to middle income countries or places which are also exist in the United States where you've got limited resources, and so, and that's probably most of the world. You're talking about what you're doing is just a very small section of the world. What should these people be doing? And I know, let me just show you this. There is another paper by, I'm sure you know about this, by Mellenkopf, and this was a paper that you see here. It was a review, and it turns out that what he says is that basically it's the surgery you're talking about, but after that it's radiation therapy and temozolomide for different grades of the tumor. And we go down to low-grade gliomas. We'll get to that in a minute. What we're talking about is what you can do in the rest of the world. What's your suggestion for people in other other areas, let me get out of here, in other areas who are low resource environments, they can't afford
Yeah.
all this stuff. What should they do?
Well, let's just back up for a minute because I think there are a couple of different ways to look at this in those environments. Excuse me. The first is to understand that throughout the world, even in low resource areas, standard of care is the way forward after surgery. So virtually every center, and I've been in many of these centers, every center is capable of using radiation therapy, and virtually every center on the planet, excuse me, is also capable of using Temodar because Temodar or temozolomide is not terribly expensive. The issue that creates this huge disparity in outcomes from these low resource environments is they're not starting with a maximal safe resection because they don't have the tools to do it. And by that, I mean not so much the bipolar or the suction. It's really the mapping techniques to be able to push the resection safely. Because no matter where I go throughout the world, I hear the same thing. We just don't want to create that kind of morbidity. We don't have those techniques. So I think what I've done is I go on a mission every year to the Philippines, where we operate at the Philippine General Hospital, one of the most indigent hospitals in the world. And through that experience, I've come up with a new technology to map brain using a very inexpensive new brain mapping system that allows us to do language mapping, motor mapping, awake or asleep, et cetera. And I'm about to achieve FDA approval, and then we'll test the first prototype in the Philippines this summer. But the bottom line is that device is going to cost literally just thousands of dollars. It's not going to be expensive. Whereas the current technology in our country, like the Integra, the Ogemin stimulator, which now doesn't exist anymore, was 50 times to 100 times more expensive. So I've decided to make a system that the third world and beyond can use so that they can do these safe resections and do maximal resections in preparation for everything else they can do, which is the standard of care. Now, when we get into low-grade gliomas, we'll talk about the new drugs, the inhibitors, and the enormous expense of those inhibitors that would prevent low-resource countries from using it. But then it gets us back into the extent of resection and outcome, and we'll talk about that as well, how important that is. But the bottom line is we have to provide these low-resource setting places the technology that's affordable so that they can do everything I can do in the first world, if you will.
I think that's terrific. We've got grand rounds. We have with Sub-Saharan Africa. There's a billion people in those 50 countries, and they're to afford something that's $5,000 is a big expense. And so, if is it something that's reasonable, fine. And then you've got to also have the backup, which is the therapy, the radiation. A lot of these people disappear into the wilderness and never see them again, and people have to. So it's a long haul. But what your history shows is you're willing to be patient to get there. I mean, if you
Exactly.
didn't have the patience, and you were talking about that with Charlie,
Yeah.
and I can understand that, and you just wouldn't persist. So we got a couple of things here. One is the tumor edge, and the other is the chemotherapy, which I think is really good. First of all, on the tumor edge, how do you said you have this technique from this Raman in India. How far does that go to the tumor edge? Have you got some studies that show you're already into normal brain, or is it infiltrated between normal brain tissue and regular tissue, which is what Shira was telling us?
Well, you can actually use the technology to chase down tumor cells. So basically, the way it goes is you do your maximal safe resection and you use navigation to the best of your ability, considering the shift that occurs during surgery, to get to that beyond contrast enhancing region. And then you begin to serially sample the tissue. Insert it into the Raman system, get a readout. It tells you whether it's tumor or no tumor. You keep going and you keep doing that. And you can get that. The key in surgery is to get immediate real-time feedback on what you're doing. In other words, you look at a piece of tissue, you know this as well as anyone, that you look at that tissue and you're not convinced it's tumor, but maybe it's tumor. Does it feel right? Does it look right? Does it have tumor in it? Well, this is a way to do that versus 30 minutes for a frozen section. This takes 2 minutes. So I think that's the way you do it. You just keep going until you're out into very, very sparse, if at all, infiltrated tissue. And that's the way we do it for both the high and the low grades.
So obviously that gets you up into the morbidity area because,
Well, mapping reduces that.
yeah, okay. So, okay, now we get to another issue you were just bringing up. And this is in the low-grade gliomas. And this is a paper on vorasidenib in low-grade glioma. And I think Tim Clancy has a paper on that. And it showed really some benefit from a very targeted chemotherapy in tumors. Is this the future?
Well, I would say, in no uncertain terms, this is a game changer for us for a number of reasons, and we can dissect all of those reasons. First of all, starting with the new WHO classification in 2021, we now are mandated to determine the IDH status of the tumor. Of course, these lower grade tumors are mutated. And when they're mutated, their metabolic activity is very different than if they're wild type. The wild type GBMs don't rely on this metabolic pathway. So if you could change the metabolism of the tumor, you could potentially reduce the growth rate of the tumor significantly. And so the goal was to develop a strategy to inhibit the product of the IDH mutation, which normally IDH converts to alpha-ketoglutarate to 2-hydroxyglutarate, or it prevents that from happening. If there's a mutation in IDH, in the IDH gene, you get the byproduct of 2-hydroxyglutarate. That drives the metabolic function of the tumor. So in that setting, if you can block the mutation, the ability to make 2-HG, you could potentially put the tumor into an idling status. So this study, to make a very long story short, this study is the third generation of the IDH inhibitor, which affects both the IDH1 mutation, which is the predominant one in low-grade tumors, and the IDH2 mutation as well, gets into the blood-brain barrier exceedingly well, which is critical in low-grade gliomas because they don't have a disrupted blood-brain barrier. And this study showed a remarkable finding that it not only prevents the time it takes to have to act on the tumor, meaning that the growth occurs and you have to do something else after you start the treatment, but it also dramatically affects progression-free survival in a hugely statistically significant way, to the point where this was a randomized study and they had to stop the arm that wasn't getting the drug. So essentially, what this has done is it's provided a way to make the tumor idle. Now, we don't know, this study did not ever get into the issue of survival because it's too soon. All we know is that it can significantly change progression-free survival to the point where you don't have to do anything. So if you back up to the patients, now the patients have an option so that if we cannot remove these tumors completely and they're IDH mutated, then they can be treated with this drug. They don't have to undergo radiation. They don't have to undergo chemotherapy, which can cause a change in the mutational status of the tumor and actually make these low-grade tumors transform to higher-grade tumors. So the standard of care based upon a radiation therapy oncology group study called 9802, published over 20 years ago, was to put the patient on radiation and chemotherapy. Now we have another option. We don't have to do that. We can do surgery and the IDH inhibitor. So it is a game changer.
Well, that was a paper I just had up. There was a paper looking at the molecular action of the IDH inhibitor. Here's the alpha-ketoglutarate isocitrate cycle. And here is the mutated IDH. It then gets you to the 2D2HG. It's all complicated for the audience, but what it does is, you're right, it basically sidetracks the tumor and from growing and metabolically, and it puts it almost in a chronic state. And it's a major accomplishment. I agree with you. So that's where things are going to go. I think there's a paper on craniopharyngioma where, again, you find the same thing. We just had a group from multidisciplinary group, Mitch, from France, working on patients with a very rare type of AVM in the face, published in the New England Journal, that has a genetic defect, a little different than this, but they were able to target that and essentially stop the growth. So it's, again, a multidisciplinary approach, something you thought about 50 years ago. And I think that's, to me, that's the way to go.
Yeah, I agree with you completely.
So look, I guess we get down to another question, and that gets back to Shearer and the paper about Paul Glusey, about the paper, guy who came back to curse me. Obviously, you've made inroads progressively with the tumor you can take care of, and now you're getting to the one that's much harder to do. Is this a surgical disease, or is it going to become a biochemical disease?
Well, unfortunately, it's always going to be a surgical disease, because a lot of times, due to the growth of this tumor, which is rapid, we see patients, you know, we've seen many patients who, for whatever reason, had a scan 6 months before they presented with a GBM. And the vast majority of them never have anything seen on the scan. So this is a rapidly growing tumor, which gets people into trouble. And the only way to deal with that rapidly is surgery. So I think surgery is clearly not going to go away for that reason. And in the very near future, it's not going to go away, because we must get the tissue to do the very extensive sequencing, looking for DNA alterations, looking for DNA methylation profiles, all the things, all what we call the omics, which are these various tests looking at proteomics, looking at all sorts of DNA determination, looking at mutations, alterations, methylation status. We have to have that tissue to do that. So I don't think surgery is going to evaporate overnight, for sure, primarily because these patients get into trouble. Now, the low-grade tumors, it's very different. They present with seizures, and they can often be controlled. So you do have time for different types of strategies. For example, you could envision a scenario where you could do a biopsy, determine IDH status, or we're working on technologies now with magnetic resonance spectroscopy, where we can actually identify 2-hydroxyglutarate as a peak. If we knew that, we could potentially think about treating some of those patients. with IDH inhibitors and see if we can turn that into a non-surgical disease. I don't know if that's possible, but it's something that we have to think about.
I
But
think.
certainly for GBM, surgery is not going to go away anytime soon.
I think that's right. Well, let's shift into to part two here, which is a little bit about you and your thinking. If you had everything to do over, what would you do differently?
Well, I don't think I would do anything differently. I think my philosophy early on was to not follow others. It was to make my own path forward and have others follow me if I was right. And if I was wrong, I knew as long as I didn't hurt patients with these tumors along the way, that it was okay. It was just a career issue that maybe I made a mistake in. But I wouldn't have done anything differently because in the very beginning, I knew I had to take a risk. I had to go into a different direction. As long as I did it in a calculated fashion and I wasn't going to hurt anybody, meaning the mapping, then I was fine with that. So it all had a happy ending. But, I think in the beginning in one's career, you have to identify something that excites you. I mean, everything excited me in the beginning in neurosurgery. How could it not? It's such a dynamic, magnificent field of medicine to be in. But you can't do everything great. You can't. I mean, we're not all people like Jim Ostman who did a lot of great things in a lot of different areas. It just doesn't happen that way. So you got to focus in, and I think you got to take a risk. And so that's basically how I built my career, and I wouldn't have changed it for anything.
I had lunch with a businessman one day, and I asked him, "What's the secret of innovation?" He told me, "Find out what everybody else is doing and don't do it."
I think that's right. But
That's a good.
you have to do, if you're going to do that, you have to do things that make sense or you think they could make sense. And there have to be signals. As I said, I got signals from the literature in the past and went from there.
I mean, just take a side trip for a couple of minutes. You presented a paper which was kind of a thought paper after 20 or 30 years of doing stimulation of the brain and the speech area. I can remember that back in the Western Neurosurgical Society. I thought it was very interesting because you were thinking about, well, geez, I hadn't really thought about all these things, and I discovered a whole bunch of things here that really are not related to the tumor. And came in the brain tumors. It's how the brain functions. Can you say that a little bit for the audience?
Well, I think again, there were two ideas here. One was built around being a tumor surgeon. I'm a tumor surgeon. I'm not a functional surgeon. That's the first thing to emphasize. And therefore, my goal as a tumor surgeon was to test the hypothesis that radical resection was beneficial for patients with gliomas. Now, having said that, I needed to figure out ways to do it safely. And that's where the functional side of things came in. As that evolved, I began to learn some incredible things that had never been published in the literature, let alone in the neurosurgical literature. And that had to do with not just cortical language localization. We had published that landmark paper in 1980, I think it was, no, 1991 with George Ogeman in the Journal of Neurosurgery, showing the largest collection ever of human language localization in the brain, based upon work that I did with George. He was the first author. I was actually the senior author on that paper, which was phenomenal. And we then built upon that to the point where I published the New England Journal of Medicine article on mapping, especially negative mapping and outcome from a morbidity point of view. And this is translated, the basic fundamental principles of language localization, both cortically and subcortically, then allowed my resident, Eddie Chang, who now has become the chair and replaced me as chair, to say, look, with all this information that we've seen that has come out of these surgeries, let's move this forward to brain-computer interface, which I think is great. It's not something I'm going to get into this late in my career, but he's already begun to do these implants to use the language information to identify the code that exists through high-frequency gamma activation that connects different cortical regions, decode that information that's recorded, and people who can't speak can't move, and get them to artificially speak and move. So you see, it's come from a continuum. Now, if I hadn't have paid attention and said to myself early in my career, wow, this is interesting. I didn't realize that the vast majority of language was in the Perisylvian system. I didn't realize that one area is connected to another through high gamma frequency activation, which we recorded during the operating room. In other words, if I hadn't have thought beyond just extent of resection and outcome, we wouldn't have had that substrate to build some of these brain-computer interface. So I think you have to always pay attention to what you're doing and then ask other questions in other areas that may not be your primary interest, but can lead to discovery and advancement of our field. And that's what we're here to do.
Well, I think that's right. What you're looking, what I always see it is you're looking, I'm looking for, if you see some anomaly, I'm looking for experiments of nature. I mean, I could sit there for 50 years and never do that. But all of a sudden, nature presents me with something. And if you aren't asking the questions, you won't find the answer. And I think that's what you're saying happened. You came across something you had totally unexpected, and it led you to do other things or led you to have other people do things. So let me ask you another question. What do you think neurosurgery is going to look like in the year 2100? You know me, I look in the future a lot. So, and things are going to evolve. It's not just today, it's tomorrow, it's what's coming. Are we going to be doing this? Is everything going to be biochemical? What's going to happen?
Well, I think for sure one of the massive advances that is happening now and will continue to happen is our ability to understand the diseases we deal with more. And by understanding them, such as in movement disorders, we've been able to think about ways in which we can divert pathways that accentuate others and relieve intention tremors, tremors in general, improve walking. So there's a perfectly good example that as time went on, we learned more and more about the origin of movement disorders and where these tremors come from. I think we're learning the same thing with oncology and certainly with vascular biology, looking at how we can change patterns of ischemia and make surgical procedures safer to do. And along with our understanding of the pathophysiology of the diseases we treat, will come commensurate advances in technology, which allow us to tap into that. In other words, better stimulators, more minimally invasive implantation strategies for stimulators, the ability to potentially obliterate vascular problems with intravascular driven technologies and things that we put in these blood vessels that are abnormal to obviate the need for certain types of surgery. It's not going to get rid of all vascular surgery, but the pathophysiology understanding, which is advancing rapidly, and the ability to sort that out through very intense bioinformatic paradigms with or without AI, because I don't think any of us really understand how AI is going to affect this field, except to maybe help us process data better, will lead to new technologies, devices we implant, devices that augment. And along with the basic surgical strategies, I mean, you could ask me this question 25 years ago about vascular surgery, and many pundits, not you, but many pundits in the field said, we're never going to have to open a patient up again to do a vascular procedure. Well, that didn't turn out to be the case, did it? And we do have ways to get around some of the surgeries, but we have other ways now. There was the thought that we could basically cure every tremor with Gamma Knife or ablation strategies. And yet that didn't pan out. We still have to put in devices that can augment function. So I don't think that's going to go away, but I think what it's going to do, it's like an exoskeleton. We're going to use things to help us do things better based on our understanding of the disease. So the technology is going to continue to advance, but it's never going to replace surgery. Surgery won't look like anything like it is today in 50 years, but it'll still be a surgical procedure.
Well, it's interesting. I think there are several things that in your career that I think have proved true. And the French paper I mentioned to you is the same. This fellow is a nephrologist who got into AVMs and vascular lesions. And he put together a multidisciplinary team which attacked this problem. And I think we're going to have to go through a period where that's basically where it is. It's probably going to be in academic centers, which means academic centers are going to have to go from silos to multidisciplinary work, and that's a major cultural shift. But then progress is going to be made. And if you look back, now we go back to the history where we started. Glioblastoma is 120 years ago. I mean, come on, where are we today? This is just an immense change. And from Guyon's injecting methotrexate into the carotid, where are we now? We got to be a little humble as people, as neurosurgeons and doctors. The changes, I think, are going to be dramatic. So, if you were advising a young person today, two things. One, should they go into medicine? And there are a lot of arguments you can give against it, central control and so forth and so on. You need innovative people like you are. You need to stimulate those people. You need to encourage them. And if you're in an environment where, like you're doing a randomized controlled study, you'd never find some of these things you're talking about with speech unless you were really paying attention to it. So we got to encourage innovation, creativity. And the young people are doing that. Maybe they're going into computer science or something else. Like you're a new head, what would you tell people, young people today, what should they do in terms of looking into medicine or looking into the future of medicine? In
Well, I
10
think
words
it's
or less.
actually, I think it's actually pretty simple. I don't think it's complicated at all. I think it all stems from the basic tenet that physicians are physicians because they serve individuals who are sick and who have problems, medically proven problems that need to be attended to and hopefully fixed. So the basic tenet of anybody should be, who goes into medicine, should be, I want to help the sick and the infirmed. Basically, that's the principle. Now, if that is what you want to do, that's very different than saying, you know, I want to become a computer scientist, and I want to work in Silicon Valley and start my own company. That's a different mindset. So if the basic principle is, you know, for whatever reason, whether it's personal or not, I want to help people. I want to help people get better. Now, having said that, I think they need to understand that this is a profession that is at high risk for government regulation. It's at high risk for salary compensation alterations that are going to make this not in the framework of socialized medicine. I don't think we're going to get there. There's always going to be options for private health insurance, but I do think that if any individual thinks they're going to go into this to make money, they're just clearly confused and mistaken. That is just not the case. So if the goal is to help people, make people better, if that's a gratifying feeling when you ask yourself that question, then this is the right profession to go into. It's not driven financially. And I think young people really don't understand what it takes to be a physician. It is not the mindset of going to work for 8 hours. It's not a shift mentality. It's a continuum, and you have to be prepared to continue into night times and weekends, et cetera, to help people out. So I think those are the basic principles. Now, having said that, it's extraordinarily rewarding from a personal point of view when you make somebody better. It's very rewarding when somebody's grateful to you for helping them. And if those are the things that are important to you, then that's really, it's a great profession. But the other thing you have to do in the profession is you have to really focus. Certainly in neurosurgery, you can't be a generalist anymore. You have to focus, and you have to pick something that you're interested in, whether it's pain, movement disorders, trauma, and you have to focus in it. And then by focusing in it, you'll start asking yourself those fundamental questions. Why did this happen? How can I make it better? What can I do in the future to change it? And that will drive your whole personality and your whole approach to medicine. So that's kind of how I would see it.
Well, I agree with you. I'm really thrilled to hear you say that, because I remember when I was in my internship at the University of Chicago, a chief resident was doing nighttime work, which, as you know, at that time, that's how people made a little extra money. And I asked him, what does it take to be successful in practice? My dad had been a doctor and so forth. So he said, you know, if you care about the patient, you'll never have to worry about money.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
And I think that's true. If you put the patient first, money will come. Don't worry about it. Okay. If you put money first, you're going to lose everything.
Yeah.
Probably including your wife.
Yeah. Well, and I think the other thing that you have to be willing to say, and I've said it over and over and over again, that's been my mantra, is if you treat patients as if you're treating your family, you will never have a double standard. No matter who the patient is, no matter where they come from, who they are, the key is if you treat them like you would treat your family, you will not have a double standard. You will give them your focus, you'll give them 110%, and you'll do the best you can for them. But it's when you try to think of this process as in a two-stage, meaning you would do something for your family versus what you would do for them, that's a mistake. Horrible mistake. You can't go down that pathway.
It's absolutely right. Treat everybody as if they're your family. Well, Mitch, it's been terrific. I really appreciate it. I think people learned a lot. I certainly appreciated talking to you. And anything we didn't talk about you wanted to say?
No, I just wanted to acknowledge the fact that I appreciate you doing this. I think it is, you know, you've always been, and you always will be known as a legendary figure in the field. Very innovative, technically magnificent. That's always been your reputation. And I think for you to take this on now and try to bridge the gap between what's happened in the past, what's evolving in the current, and to speculate about the future, I think it's great, because I don't see other people doing it. So I applaud you for doing it, and I hope it gets people thinking in ways that they hadn't been thinking of. So carry on.
Well, thanks a lot. It gets back to what you were doing. You get a lot of different people together. You've traveled all over the world, and you talk to people. You know that there's bright people everywhere. They just aren't here in the United States or Europe. And then when you talk to them, you learn a lot of stuff. And it makes you humble. And I think you've achieved a terrific, done a lot. And your goals have been very gratifying. And I think the end result is what you just said. What's the treasure in medicine? There's not enough money in the world to buy it. Is the satisfaction of helping somebody.
Mm-hmm.
If you go into it for money, you made more money than anybody else could ever dream of.
Yeah.
So basically, in your soul, you're a rich person.
Yeah, exactly right. Good way to state it. Thanks,
Okay.
Jim.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
All right, see you.
These are the references that were discussed during the interview we had with Mitch. Be ready to take some screenshots so you can save it for your records and look up the references if you have some interest. First reference is a recent review on glioblastoma and other primary brain malignancies. Actually, it reviews them all and gets to the basic principle that it's surgery for sure, for sur first radiation and temozolomide, which, as you will see Mitch talk about, can be used everywhere in the world. The second is his outstanding paper that they published in 2020, proving really with a large series of patients how surgery is of direct benefit in extending life, quality life in patients using techniques that he's developed throughout his career, brain mapping, stimulation of the brain, and taking out the remnants of the computer enhanced, of the contrast enhanced tumor, and getting now to the non-contrast portion. There was a paper published in 1940 by a Dr. Scheer from Belgium, which is actually one of the finest papers I've read in medicine. Didn't have a lot of technology, but it was an outstanding paper, which in which he sectioned the brain of people with tumors from front to back, multiple sections, and analyzed pathologically the extent of the tumor. It's discussed in the talk, and particularly with regard to gliomas, that they're very infiltrative tumors. And the question is, that's the pathologic basis for what we're doing today. The next is a paper by Dr. Mellinghoff and a list of authors, which with Tim Clousey, who's a neuro-oncologist at UCLA, who has an independent presentation on SNI Digital, actually, if you look it up, in which he talks about low-grade gliomas and this very significant step in the management of tumors, brain tumors, where they can be treated with a targeted molecular acting agent that essentially stops the growth. As Mitch has mentioned, there's a very, very significant change. It's a game changer, in his words. This is the key paper that is the key paper showing this targeted therapy as being successful. And the paper that follows is a very detailed presentation in the British Journal of Cancer, saying what's the molecular sites of action of this targeted therapy, excuse me, in the people with IDH1 and IDH2 mutants. It's an interesting paper. It's complicated to read, but it shows the fundamental biochemical basis. We hope you enjoyed this presentation. The material provided in this program is for informational purposes. It's not intended for use as a diagnosis or treatment of a disease or health problem, or as a substitute for consulting a licensed medical professional. Fill out the evaluation of this video. It's on the rating on the main video on the main website. It's a rating scale on the bottom from 1 to 5. That helps us improve our programming, and if you want some CME credit, let us know and we'll send you a certificate. This session is recorded and is available free on snidigital.org. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions for us on what we can do to make it better, CME requests, write to ausman@snidigital.org. There are many ways to learn. a foundation. Supporting these journals supports two different ways to learn. One is SNI, Surgical Neurology International. It's a 2D internet journal, like all the other journals. Nancy Epstein is its editor-in-chief. And this new journal, SNI Digital Innovations in Learning, which is only video, a video-only 3D journal, with interactive with discussion among people from around the world. So you can learn in many different ways. Both of these publications are free 24/7, 365. Surgical Neurology International was started in 2010. It's now read in 239 territories and countries around the world, the third largest readership in the world. And SNI Digital Innovations in Learning is now seen in 141 countries after 8 months of publication to look at this all-new video journal on neurosurgery. Purpose of the foundation and the goals behind these journals are to help people throughout the world. In addition, the foundation supports the Medical News Network, which is to bring truthful medical and science news to the world. This program has been copyrighted by the James I. and Carolyn R. Hausman Educational Foundation. It's a charitable foundation on IRS USA 501c3, operating charitable foundation. All rights are reserved. We hope you enjoyed this. Thank you very much.